Club. Driving. No purchase necessary.
You're listening to Radio Free Urbanism.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to Radio Free Urbanism, a podcast about urbanism and stuff. My name is Nick Laporte, and I'm joined by one of my co-hosts here. You know him, you love him, Ethan Myers.
Welcome back, everybody.
And we actually have a very special guest today. This is a bonus episode, not a typical episode of the show. And we have with us from Movement, that's Metro Vancouver Transit Riders, Dennis Agar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on this non-typical episode.
Yeah.
You'll know it's non-typical because it's blue.
It is. It should be blue. If you're on YouTube watching this, it's blue. And thanks to Alex for setting that up for us. So this is the second of our bonus episodes where we get to talk to somebody. So I've been wanting to talk to Dennis for quite a while. I first heard about you when you were on Helen Loy's podcast, Urbanism Vancouver. And it was fascinating. I remember a few quotes that you had on there, and one in particular that really sparked my interest, and I know I've mentioned it on the podcast before, is that, so in Vancouver, there's two main bridges over the Narrows, right? And you said that the car traffic over those bridges peaked like 20 years ago. And I thought that was absolutely fantastic in kind of encapsulating the point about how we can make traffic disappear by making better places. Anyways, I don't want to go into that right now, but anyway, can you just tell us, like, an elevator pitch? Who is Dennis Agar?
An elevator pitch of myself?
Yeah.
Man, this Absolutely. Is like... no.
Right into the fire.
I am really into transit. I'm obsessed with it. I really think it's, like, the solution to, like, a lot of our problems. I always say, if you tell me what you care about, and I'll tell you why transit is something you should care about too. I came up through urban planning school and spent a good chunk of time at TransLink, kind of trying to, you know, carve out roles where we could, you know, I could try and make transit better in this region. And came to the point where, like, based on what I knew about how to make transit better, the next move was to go out of the organization. And now I'm working with some really passionate people on a nonprofit to push for better transit.
That's awesome. So there's things that I'm really curious about, because, like, we've talked about on this podcast that we're more or less casuals. We're content creators who are passionate about urbanism in our different areas of interest. Myself, micromobility, Alex, kind of a more holistic feet on the ground urbanism, and obviously Ethan, transit. So can you tell us about how you got interested in urban planning and what that was like, your experience?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, Nick, you were telling me a little bit about your life before this call, and I haven't told you anything about mine. I am from a small town in Eastern Ontario, outside of Ottawa, where we basically didn't have any transit at all. Like, the only transit that I used from our, like, rural acre that I grew up on was the school bus. And I went away for university studying something generally unrelated, like business. And it was like a big awakening, even in that first week at university, like, oh, this is what it's like to live in a city. You're connected with people. You can do things. Oh, this is what it means to have transit. And I happened to watch a movie in the first week of school called, it was a documentary called The End of Suburbia, which I don't think aged too well. But in any case, it was really meaningful for me at the time. And it was basically like a red siren, like, cities are the things that are causing climate change. And we can totally fix it. We have the solutions. And from then on, it was just falling down a rabbit hole. Like, I was reading official plans for different cities in my free time and, like, getting really into urban planning and really getting to the point where I'm like, okay, I need to switch programs. And I ended up doing an undergrad in urban planning at TMU in Toronto, formerly Ryerson, and just loved it. Loved every second of it. And the transit element of it really set off my neurons. Like, I love networks and thinking about networks. And I was just like, this is it for me. I want to get into transit. And again, just really good fortune to, you know, I was out there in the job market, and the first place that got back to me that offered me an interview was TransLink out in Vancouver. And that brought me out 10-ish years ago, and here I still am. Just, you know, slogging away, trying to make transit better.
So you don't work for Translink anymore, right?
Not anymore. I quit last Halloween.
Last Halloween. All right. So we're getting closer to a year.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations for taking that step, because that's pretty huge.
Thank
you. So I've been really curious about this, because I first met an urban planner who works for Translink right now, actually, about, I don't know, 7 or 8 months ago. And I was really curious about their position there and what that involves, but we didn't actually have the chance to talk about it. So I'm really happy to have you here. So I can ask you, what the hell does an urban planner do at Translink?
There are so many different things. Like, I mean, I feel like if you even just ask, what does an urban planner do in general?
Yeah.
You're going to get an essay as an answer, because it's not an easy thing to answer. Like, what I can tell you is that what I did was generally focused on continuing to tweak the bus network to make it better. Maybe that's like the shortest possible answer I can give. But there are people there that are focused on, you know, managing the accessible transit service, HandyDart. There are people there that are thinking about, you know, we have to get this much money in the next 10 years or else we're screwed. People that are thinking about, like, oh, well, like, how does the gas tax revenue and people switching to EVs, how does that affect transit service on, like, your street corner? Like, there's a million different things, and it's generally all around focusing on keeping transit at least as good as it is, and ideally, you know, finding ways to make it better somehow.
Interesting. That's interesting. Ethan, do you have any?
I should also mention other modes too. Translink is a multimodal agency. I'm a bus guy, but there are people there that are focused on goods movement, like freight, and there are people there that are focused on cycling and walking, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so it's like a hyper focused role that you would have.
Yeah. I mean, Translink is much more responsible for transit than all those other things. Like, it doesn't own any cycling facilities, and so those are more about getting other governments, like cities, to do better on cycling, whereas Translink owns the buses. So there's way more people focused on that at Translink.
So is Translink also focused with, like, road redevelopment as well, or are they just purely, like, transit? Okay, so they're, like, kind of, like, mixed in with, like, so I grew up in the Chicago area, and there were two different agencies, well, multiple different agencies, but usually for transit there was RTA, which would handle buses, they would handle the elevated lines, and they would handle commuter rail through a few different other agencies. And then there was CDOT that would handle all the street work and stuff like that. So Translink is both of these agencies combined, streets and transit.
Kind of. Like, Translink doesn't really own any streets. I actually don't think I can generalize or say anything with certainty with anything to do with Translink, because everything is fuzzy. Translink generally doesn't own the streets. The lever that it has to make the actual roads that cars drive on better is that it funds like 50% of a specific network of roads that are considered like major. They also own the bridges that the province didn't want to keep owning because they were kind of crappy. So like when Translink was founded in 1999, it was just a combination of all the things that the province didn't want to do and all of the things that were too politically sensitive that the province didn't really want to get blamed if it went sideways. It's a marvel that it works, frankly. It's quite surprising. But I also think it's like, I mean, this is going to sound really self-serving, but I do think in a lot of ways it's the best transit agency in North America. And I really enjoyed working there. And the problems that we see today in the network are largely a consequence of that success, which is just unbelievably severe overcrowding in more and more places every day.
There is no better problem you could have for a transit agency.
There's too many people using it.
Too many people are using it. How do we get that away? That's a problem that 99% of transit agencies in the U.S. wish they could have. Well, every transit agency in the U.S. wish they could.
Yeah, I'm constantly thinking about that quote. Oh, it's too crowded there. Nobody goes anymore. And that's how sometimes I feel about transit. It's just like, how do people go on the bus when they have to wait for four buses to pass before there's room on one to actually get on it?
No, it's pretty incredible. And I know we'll talk about it a bit more later, but the 49. Is it called the 49? Yeah. I rarely take transit. I'm like micromobility for the most part, unless whatever. Anyway, standing there at Cambie and 49th, I think, and seeing there's a lot of buses that come, articulated buses too, a lot of them, and they still would just like pack up people. To every 2 minutes, 4 minutes, a bus would come, but still, it would just get absolutely full. I couldn't believe how many people are getting on the bus. It's wild.
Yeah, man, it's incredible. If you like those like nature documentaries, or like sometimes they'll do ones with cities where it's just kind of like a nature documentary, but it's like scenes from the city, go to the corner of 49th and Cambie in Vancouver and just watch. Like, the line will disappear into that bus, and then it'll just reappear immediately after.
Yeah.
That bus, the 49, moves twice as many people as Via Rail Canada, our national railway.
Oh, my God. I don't know if that says anything about the 49 or Via Rail more, but
that's the question. Man. Yeah,
well, I enjoy that one. There's a lot of thinking that goes on after you hear that.
So. Oh my God! Yeah, there's a lot of things I have to say about Via Rail, but that is still very impressive to think that buses move that many people. That's incredible. All right, and before we get into the nitty gritty of these buses, I want to ask you about this. Obviously, this okay. If you're not on YouTube right now, go check out, because you got to see Dennis's sweater he's got on. It's fantastic. So
it's incredible.
Repping for Movement. So can you tell us about Movement, what it is and why you started it?
Movement is a group that's fighting for better transit. It's a nonprofit. It's meant to be, grassroots. And you know, there are so many, really successful groups across North America that inspired us, Transit Alliance, Miami, Riders Alliance in New York, Transit Matters in Boston, TTC Riders in Toronto. Like, there are so many groups out there that are fighting the good fight and demonstrating that when you get riders engaged in the fight for better transit, you actually win things. Like TTC Riders in Toronto, they had a huge win recently where the city was going to shut down. There's this opportunity to get a busway while a rail line was shut down for years. And the city staff said no. They recommended to council not to do it. And then the mayor overturned it after TTC Riders got involved. But anyway, so that's the dream, right? Like, we haven't had a group like that in Metro Vancouver. And I can't really understand why. I do wonder if it's because it's so hard to start something in this region because it's so expensive. You just need money to eat. And like, to take a risk is like life or death. But anyway, I was in a really fortunate position to be able to quit my job and start this. And, we're going to get really big. That's the goal, is we want to get really big and like a credible threat, right? Like a credible, this is, if you don't make the transit riders happy, you're going to have to pay for it come election time.
It's a force in the community, right?
That's the dream, right? We have a million people in this region that ride transit at least once a week, out of like population of like 2.7, 2.8. And so that's like almost 40% of the region that's on buses. And if we can even get 5% of them on our list and engaged and active, that could overturn elections. We could build coalitions with every major institution in the region, like faith groups, cultural groups, whomever, it's all doable. And frankly, it just shouldn't be such a struggle. It shouldn't be such a struggle here where transit is so prevalent. So there you go. That's Movement.
Awesome. Sweet. So can you share it right now? Just do a shameless plug about Movement, where to find it.
Sure. Yes, please. Go to our website, transitmovement.ca. Excuse me. And there's a join us link there and a donate link as well. Please click both. but right now all it is, joining our newsletter counts, and we have all sorts of stuff. I've actually was just working on a newsletter today, where, we'll have walks and events and speaking engagements and opportunities to like help in certain ways. And so, there's lots of stuff to do.
Yeah, I definitely recommend that, the newsletter, especially because there's things that I've gotten in the newsletter that I wouldn't have heard about in other channels or platforms that I use. So, yeah, if you're interested in this stuff when it comes to transit in Vancouver especially, definitely follow that. So back to the sweater, and this is something I want to talk about, not specifically, but just like as a picture. Yeah. But when we talk about transit, right, especially in the political sense, buses get left out because it's just like, oh yeah, buses. Buses are buses. They're here. They're on the street. We talk about rail, right? And in the imagery of transit, when people think about transit, they often think about trains. Different channels we see on YouTube when they're talking about transit, they'll have a train, right? Another podcast that I like, The Red Line, there's a train. On our little podcast art, there's a train there, right? But you guys have a bus, and we talked a little bit about this already, but why the bus, and why is the bus so important to a good transit system?
I think, okay, so there's two pieces that I want to bring together. The first piece is that it's really easy to get people to complain about their commute, right? Like, and if yeah. you're trying to organize an organization and grow and get big, you know, a bus rider is just standing there in a public place on a city sidewalk, and you can go and talk to them, and usually they'll unload on you about all the issues that you have about the bus. And what an easy way to get them to join, right? Like, because you can say to them, well, here's what we want to change. And so there are a lot of problems with the bus network in Metro Vancouver, and the rail network is like kind of chugging along in you know, a bit of a better way. You know, buses move more people in Metro Vancouver than trains. Like, I think 60% of the trips that happen on this system are by bus.
Unless you're MTA in New York, everybody is moving more people by bus than by train.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so the other side of this is that it's so easy and quick to make the buses way better, you know, like, buying more buses and building more garages for them, that, you know, there's a lead time on that. But there are so many cities in North America that are pushing forward with bus lanes in like a remarkably fast way. From Boston to Los Angeles to Seattle to New York, they're just painting bus lanes and putting a little overhead sign and then you're done. And that part is, I think, where Metro Vancouver has really fallen behind. And I mean, you are a product of your experiences, and this is really comes from my experiences in the last few years that I was at TransLink. We were on a brand new team called Bus Speed and Reliability. And we were focused on, you know, we had this pot of money that we're giving out to the cities who own the streets to try and get them to put in transit priority, bus lanes, queue jumps, signal priority, all that stuff. And they wouldn't take the money. And the projects that they were proposing were very meek and mild. And it demonstrated a deep fear in reallocating road space towards transit. I think maybe partially it was a justified fear, right? Nick might remember back in 2018, we had a big bus fight in the city of West Vancouver. It's part of Metro Vancouver. It's the richest city in Canada. And TransLink had a big plan to extend an express bus through that area. And I'll spare you all the details, but the businesses rose up and they successfully chopped the line so it ends right at the boundary of West Vancouver.
Oh, God.
And there was no one on the other side of that. There was no one to uphold the bus side, aside from TransLink, but of course they're going to defend the plan that they're proposing, right? Like, there was no external group of riders saying, we need this. And West Van, for it being a rich area, actually has a lot of transit ridership. That would have been pretty easy to organize, but there was just no one out there organizing it. So, so it's like, where am I going with this? It's easy, cheap, and fast to massively improve bus service. And when you put in a bus lane, it makes that bus route cheaper to operate. It saves TransLink money. And then you can get TransLink to use all those savings to make the service a higher capacity, more frequent, more night service, you know, whatever. You can use the savings however you want. And so that's kind of the treadmill that I want us to get on. Like, paint the bus lane, save the money, reinvest the money, more ridership, and then just keep going.
Mm-hmm. So I think a big problem with people have with buses a lot of the time is that they get stuck in traffic, right? Mm-hmm. And even here where we have these, you know, rapid, they call them, you know, scare quotes, rapid buses, they have that issue where they're pretty quick. They're pretty good, but they still get stuck in traffic. And that's because a lot of our bus lanes are on the rightmost lane, in which is also used as a turning lane or some personal driver's express lane if they want to, because there's a lack of enforcement, right? So I'm wondering, like, what are there things that we could do practically and easily and cheaply, you know, in the same line of implementing more buses that could help prevent that and keep these buses moving faster.
I bet Ethan's got lots of answers to this too, but where do I start?
Let's hear from the experts.
Well, I mean, the gold standard is like bus rapid transit, right? Like, this is a buzzword. Like, what does it even mean? The whole point of bus rapid transit is to use buses to emulate the benefits you get from a subway or a metro or a SkyTrain, right? Like, so obviously the gold standard, like you could totally design a bus network that is just as good and fast as a rail, like a metro network. It has to be completely grade separated, either underground or above ground, whatever. So that's like the best possible thing you could do, is completely separate cars from traffic. And then the worst possible thing you could do is what we have right now with buses, where there's pretty much no priority. The stops are really close together. The traffic signals don't communicate with the buses at all, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we're all about is just moving things over. Like, basically, there are lots of little ways that you can protect the people in a bus from congestion. And bus lanes is the big one, and I really like those. I think, you know, you see some exciting moves like the Van Ness Avenue in San Francisco, or Columbus Avenue in Boston, are examples of where they've taken a normal bus route and put it in the middle of the street with stations on either side. And when you're in the middle, you're not prone to being blocked by right turning cars. And usually they ban left turns, or they have like a whole weird phase for it. And so the buses can just fly in the middle, and they have these platforms. And so that's median BRT. And that's something that I think we don't have an example of in Metro Vancouver, but we're starting to maybe talk about, and, excuse me, maybe we'll see it on 200th Street in Langley pretty soon.
I think in London, Ontario, that's their plan for their bus rapid transit in a lot of places, that center lane BRT.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's starting to become more of a standard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
hopefully.
And it's great. Like, it is the dream in a lot of ways. I mean, I guess the dream is heavy rail, right? Like, eventually,
yeah. Yeah. Yes, please.
You know, because a lot of this too, like, I don't want anyone to think that I'm like anti-rail, because ultimately I really see feeding bus ridership as a way of building that voting constituency to support the upgrade to rail. Like, I think that it's not either or, it's like a staircase. Anyway, I wanted to get that in. But median bus lanes, great. Curbside bus lanes, sure, fine. They're so easy to do, right? Like, it's literally just, you just paint a diamond, you put a sign, and it's there. But then you have to contend with cars that are turning right or using it illegally. For the illegal ones, you know, cities like Los Angeles have started using cameras that'll snap a picture of a license plate. And, you know, we could do that here. We would need provincial legislation to allow TransLink to do that. So that's a barrier that you can talk to your MLA about, if you want, listeners in British Columbia. your MLA is your elected, like, local representative. And then for right turning cars, one way to get them out of there is to have a dedicated right turn signal, so that you can flush those right turning cars out, you know, maybe at the end of the cycle. But anyway, so that's just a deep dive to say that there are so many little tools that we could deploy if we were all focused on that as a goal. And the unfortunate thing is that a lot of engineers are trained in the art of moving cars quickly. And when we start talking about moving buses, it's just like, hold on, wait a minute. This is like totally counter to our goals.
Yeah. We've just been, you know, like forced into the, you know, the car dependency of just, you know, the traffic engineer mindset of moving only cars rather than, you know, getting people from point A to point B, which should really be the goal of urban transportation.
Yeah. And, you know, it says on my compost bin outside, it says Vancouver, greenest city. But we're actually falling really far behind a lot of American cities on moving the humble bus around, like the workhorse of the transit system, as everyone always says. Mm-hmm. Seattle, if you go to downtown Seattle, they have 24-hour bus lanes on most, it feels like most major streets in downtown Seattle. But 3 hours north here in Vancouver, we've got almost none.
Yeah, it's too bad. It seems like a lot of things are falling behind in Vancouver, in the metro area. We have some things happening. Obviously, we have these SkyTrain extensions, but I think those are long overdue things that are catching up to what should have expanded a long time ago. That's too bad. So Can you speak to some of the, at least, successes of the buses in Vancouver? Some things that have, like, really stand out statistics or facts about them.
Sure. You know, that's not, I'm usually kind of a downer about buses in Vancouver. But so let me just change my mental mode. That's transit agency in North America. Okay, now we can, now we're talking. Ages ago, TransLink, it really focused on having a bus network that is a grid. It was like one of the first agencies to really take that seriously. And the transit expert, Jarrett Walker, who you may have heard of, he kind of wrote the Bible on transit planning, or at least bus route planning. He spent a lot of time at TransLink. He worked at TransLink for a while. And it's where I think he learned a lot of his stuff. And so anyway, so the magic of having a grid is kind of the magic of being in a car, in the sense that you can pick a direction, pick a way to go somewhere, right? Like, you're not being forced into this central transfer point and then back out like a FedEx package. You can go to any one of these cross streets and then transfer onto a different bus. And as long as they're all frequent enough, you can define frequency maybe in different ways, but as long as they're all frequent, then you won't really have to think about it. Like, if you're down here, like in this bottom left corner, and you're going to the top right corner, you know, you just get on a bus, it just shows up when you're waiting for it, and then you just transfer. You don't have to wait more than a few minutes at your transfer point, and then just switch over. And actually, what's exciting right now is TransLink's re-examining the bus network in that main chunk of Vancouver, which includes Vancouver, Burnaby, and New West. And we, some volunteers on our team really worked hard on a submission to that plan process. And one of the things they really focused on was to continue that grid, because in East Vancouver, which is where I live, the grid kind of just falls apart. And there are parts of it where, you know, you can't do that. You can't have that amazing freedom of a grid. So that's an aside, but, and the, maybe I can get my little negative message in here, from a positive question by saying that, TransLink hasn't had really any significant money to increase service since before the pandemic. No one really expected demand to return the way it did after the pandemic. And so, they've done their best to shuffle buses around the region to address overcrowding where it's the worst. But that doesn't mean that if you shuffle a bus from one place to another, it doesn't mean that there's no overcrowding in the other place. It's just less. And so that grid that I was talking about that Vancouver became famous for is actually operating at way less frequency than it was like 5 years ago. Like some routes like Fraser, Victoria, Maine, Granville, you know, they were running at 12, 15 minute frequency when they used to be 8.
Wow.
Yeah. And, wow, and that's because the ridership growth was so much more intense in Surrey. And so a lot of those service hours were taken and put into buses in Surrey. Okay. But who's going to backfill all this stuff in Vancouver? That's what we need a plan for.
Right. So has the ridership come back after COVID?
Yeah.
It has. Oh, wow. Okay. Because I know it was a bit slow at first. I didn't realize it came right back. That's great.
And it has been slower in Vancouver. And I think that's probably attributed to the fact that cycling is more competitive in Vancouver and that there are more people with higher income jobs that are able to either switch to a car or work from home. Whereas Surrey is really a place where with a lot of people with service jobs, and, you know, a lot of growth. So I think there is truth to that like the ridership recovery has been way higher in Surrey than in Vancouver. But yeah, we're seeing routes that are like 130-140% of pre-COVID ridership.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Wow.
So on that topic about these routes, let's talk about 49th, because I know you wanted to talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, I would love to talk about 49th. It's fascinating. It cuts through the most diverse parts of Metro Vancouver. Some of these neighborhoods that it passes through are 80 to 85% people of color. It's a really long route. It goes from the University of British Columbia through a rich area to a middle-class area with a college, and then on to Metrotown, which is like the biggest mall in the region. And it was actually a route that organizers and riders fought for back in the 70s. It didn't exist before there was a fight. And someone put up a plaque on, I think, Main Street at the corner of 49th that you can find on a lamppost. And they commemorated the people that fought for the 49th. But anyway, it exists. It moves like way more than 30,000 people a day. And it is so overcrowded. Like, we are constantly hearing from riders along 49th, there it is, that there's just not enough service. They get left behind by four or five buses in a row. And then in just in that middle portion, kind of where it says Punjabi Market there, like, a lot of people might assume that this route is really focused on serving people, getting them to the university and to Langara College. But what we see is actually it's a lot of people just going to work, you know, like that are going from that middle section of 49th to either the Canada line on one side or the Expo line on the other side to get them to the SkyTrain to take them to wherever their job is. Mm-hmm. That street has four lanes. It's four lanes wide. And two of them are mostly used for free parking, 24 hours for residential uses. There's no real retail on 49th. And so it's a real it's a missed opportunity to have all that road space dedicated to just free parking. And we think that the problems are so dire on the 49 and it's so widely used that we could actually, I think when we actually go to the doorstep and talk to people, we'll get a lot of people who agree to give up their own parking, who will say like, it's fine. I can park in my garage. I can park on the side street. I would rather have bus lanes instead of parking. And I think that would really transform the community. Like, we could save TransLink somewhere over $1 million a year in operating expense that we can then go to them and say, okay, the community fought for this. What do we want, to have in its, like, how do we want to spend the savings basically? And I expect a lot of people to say we want overcrowding relief, but maybe we want a whole new route on 57th. There's a big gap in service that there could have a whole new route. But that's kind of the model of movement that I really want to push, is that we go to the stops, we talk to people at the doorstep, we build support for this thing that maybe people are like, the engineers at the city are like, oh, we can do this. It's too scary. There's going to be too many opponents. We can demonstrate that there's way more supporters than there are opponents. And then they do it. We make sure TransLink reinvests the savings into good things, and then we move on to the next community.
Right. So how long is that route actually? Because I know it obviously goes all the way to UBC. Mm-hmm. Eastwards, how far does it go?
To Metrotown.
To Metrotown, Burnaby. Okay.
So yeah, it crosses through three municipalities essentially. And yeah. It's like, I think if you ride it from end to end, it's punishing. It's probably 70 or 80 minutes long.
Oh. Yeah, that's a long ride. Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, it's interesting to hear, you know, a lot of the people aren't just like, oh, they live in Burnaby and they're going all the way to UBC. There's a lot of people might think that's just a lot of students going to the universities or coming from there. But mm-hmm. It's kind of like what we found out about the route. I'm sorry. I'm so dumb when it comes to the names of the lines.
The
SkyTrain in Vancouver. But what's the one that goes all the way to Port Moody? Is that Millennium?
That's the Millennium Line, yeah.
The one that's being extended, right?
Yeah.
So that's what they found out, right? Or at least what they're saying is that they're only extending it to Arbutus and not all the way to UBC, is because a lot of people are using the interim space on the B line, right? The 99.
Yeah. That, like, it's going to serve the hospital in that kind of central Broadway area. And that's actually where a lot of the 99 riders are going. That said, I still think they should just keep the tunnel boring going, but that's another conversation. Yeah.
You got it down there. I mean, you might as well.
It's already underground. Just keep it moving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another mile and a half.
Yeah.
If that.
Yeah. Yeah. So are the buses along 49th, or at least I'm fascinated by the trolley buses here in Vancouver, because I didn't realize that it was such a unique thing that we had.
Yeah.
Because I came here and took it for granted. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's Vancouver. It's a bigger city than where I came from. They're going to have buses that are electric. That's cool.
Yeah.
So is this like the only city in North America that's got these things?
It's the only city left in Canada.
Ones.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, only one.
There's four other ones. There's San Francisco with Muni. There's Seattle with King County. There's Philadelphia with SEPTA. And then here's the real outlier, Dayton, Ohio.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
We kept it. Good for them. Yeah.
They kept it. They kept it. I think there's like four or five lines that are like purely, I think they're half trolley bus and then like half battery off the wire.
Yeah. And I think Boston got rid of theirs recently.
They just did last year.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah. You know, trolley buses are an interesting thing because, yeah, we're putting so much effort into electrifying transport and like, oh, how do we get these batteries to have enough power in them? Oh, well, we've been doing this for 100 years. You just hook it up to a wire and then it's already done. I will say from the operational side, from the time I've spent at TransLink, trolley buses have disadvantages. Like the fact that it has to remain connected is a real bummer when you're trying to get buses moving quickly because, you know, I've heard people argue that it's just the way the wires are maintained in this region, but I do ultimately think that like, if you commute on a trolley bus in Vancouver, you know the shortcomings of it. You know that sometimes the thing falls off the wires and then you have to sit there for 2 minutes. The driver has to get out, like kind of just mess with it until it reconnects to the wire. You have to go slow through left turns. You have to, if you're on a route with, or a corridor with like three routes on it and you're like stuck behind another bus, like say there's a 20 up here and you're on a 16 behind it, that 20 is really popular and it's picking up a lot of people and maybe the 16 isn't, it's just passing through, you can't pass. So there are disadvantages to trolley buses, but what I'm really excited about is the idea of an in-motion charging trolley bus, IMC trolleys, and they're just starting to be marketed. Hopefully we'll get some soon, but they'll go like 40, 50 kilometers off wire. So like it has a battery, but it's not an enormous battery. And what it'll mean is that like what I'm hoping it'll mean for TransLink is that it can run when it's the only bus on a route and it's a simple straight route, it can charge up and just go straight. And then when it goes into those complicated areas with turns and it's sharing corridors with other buses, then it can go off wire and then just fly through and then, you know, do the same on its way back out.
Interesting. So it has like a catch up top where that like a channel, it just guides it right back onto a line. That's
you have
cool.
to do it in a certain spot. Like there's there would be designated spots where it rewires and then it's like a little hat. And then the pole just comes up and it finds its way in the hat and it reconnects.
Cool. That's
so it's
brilliant.
More like a pantograph than like an actual like trolley wire.
It is technically a trolley wire and the trolley poles I think would be identical to the way they are today. They would just be maybe have some smart technology on it that would put it in the right direction so it can find the target or whatever. And then there's like a little guide, like V-shaped guide that it would just fall into.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's apparently common in Europe, like so many of the things that we're just trying to figure out. Yes. Normal in Europe.
Because I have seen some battery electric buses that do charging, and they actually use a pantograph on the top of them to charge battery electric buses. And I'm just like, I wonder if we could use that instead of the normal, you know, battery electric technology, but I wonder if it's something with the voltage that I don't have the electrical knowledge to deal with, nor would you want me to.
Me too. Yeah, pantographs are like these big things that sweep against the wire, right? And so there's no real...
Yeah, like what trains use.
Yeah, so that would solve some problems. I'm sure there's a reason why we don't use pantographs.
There probably is. There's probably a good reason.
Not for us to figure out, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Ethan, you got some questions in here. Why don't you fire away?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're talking about transit. We're talking about buses. I think it's only proper to talk about transit-oriented development because it's a word that gets thrown around a lot in the urbanist space, and it gets thrown around a lot by transit agencies. So I was wondering, Dennis, if you could clarify what transit-oriented development is and how we can make it work in existing developments.
Sure. A real primer. Transit-oriented development is like a modern rebranding of a concept that's like pretty much as old as time, which is that as the town or the city or the village or the settlement that you're building is only as good as the places you can get to in it with the technology of the day, right? So like before we had transit, before we had cars, towns were only as big as you could just walk or maybe ride a horse. Because if you make a town bigger than that, what's the point? Like it's going to take forever to get to it. And there's like a natural cap on the size of towns. And so one of the first technologies to break that was a streetcar. And you got these long fingers of development out of the town that followed the streetcar line, because all of a sudden it was like, you know, you could get to these like distant places that used to be like so far, now they're only 30 minutes with this nice new streetcar. And so all of the development would be focused on it, and you can see neighborhoods like that in your city, I guarantee you, that, that were developed around the streetcar. If it's a store that comes up to the sidewalk and has not really a lot of parking, it was probably focused on a streetcar. And so now, we kind of forgot how to do that for like 60-ish years, and now we're talking about it constantly because it was such a no-brainer. We're really trying to get cities and transit agencies and everyone to work together to just put stuff close to trains. Like, it's really simple. you know, like, and I often think about the network impact of it. Like, I really want to try and get as many people as I can to think about network effects, because, like, for instance, moving a thing can be just as beneficial as building a whole new train. Like, imagine like a university or something that everyone is going to in this transit network. Like, you could spend $10 billion building a train to this university, or you could literally move that university and it might cost $10 billion. And you know what I mean? And that would offer the exact same benefit. Actually, maybe even more of a benefit, because you would have, you know, you wouldn't have to go that whole distance. This is something for Vancouverites. I always talk about the Tsawwassen Ferry Terminal. Like, no, we don't need to build a train to Tsawwassen Ferry Terminal. We just need to move the ferries. But anyway, so transit-oriented development is really just like everything becomes better and easier when you put homes and stores and schools and everything close to transit. It shifts what's normal for you. Because, you know, you grow up in the suburbs, what's normal? Jump in a car to do everything. But if you have that train station right next to you, all of a sudden it's normal to just take transit everywhere. And it's really life changing in a lot of ways. And what was the second part of the question?
We often talk about transit oriented development.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to terms of like trains.
Yeah.
Everybody uses trains.
Yeah.
But what about buses?
Yeah.
I mean, like, we can absolutely use buses, but I mean, like, does it differ in any sort of meaningful way? I mean, it's just oftentimes we kind of have this like train focused mindset when in all reality, we need to start looking a bit more at buses.
I think you're right. I was using trains as a shorthand, but at the end of the day, when you're thinking about like in terms of network effects, all that really matters is that the person is in a moving box on wheels. And what matters is how quickly that box is moving and how many things you can get to using that box. Right. Like, it's really useful when people start seeing maps, heat maps of accessibility. So like everyone from wherever you live, you can get to a certain number of jobs in maybe 45 minutes on transit. And you can make a map of that. So certain places, it's really a lot easier to get to jobs, or it's really a lot easier to get to IKEAs or to community centers. And that's how we can think about transit-oriented development, is that when you put all those things next to a station, it increases the number of places you can get to by transit. And the only difference between that and putting people TODs next to a bus line is it really just depends on how quickly that bus moves. If it's moving as quickly and as reliably as a train, then it has the same benefit. There might be some perception issues amongst the people that are trying to buy or rent places in that neighborhood, but in most urban regions in North America, the housing market is so constrained and the vacancy rates are so low that people will figure out real quick that a bus TOD is going to offer them really good mobility, as long as it does, as long as the buses are fast and frequent and reliable.
Fast, frequent, reliable.
Yeah.
Something a lot of North America is short in.
Yeah. Yeah. Fast and reliable transit, or FART for short. That was a rejected project name when I was a translator. Short-lived.
I'm sure it would have got somebody.
I wonder
in.
Why. Yeah.
But maybe not the masses. That's good.
So speaking of the masses, we've been seeing this growth in, you know, the online urbanist community. Uh-huh. And a lot of us, Nick and I included, we're not exactly experts in this community. We're kind of, I believe the term was coined by my friend Alan Fisher, armchair urbanists, where we're kind of just on the sideline, you know, kind of, you know, making our calls, you know, on like, hey, city should do this. But as someone with experience working in, you know, a transit agency, whether, you know, how long it was or not, it still lent you access to the professional world on this. So what's one thing that some of us armchair urbanists need to know about transit, or just one thing that you'd like us to understand that the armchair urbanist community really doesn't at the moment? Or at least the online urbanist space.
Man, that's a great question. I honestly just love you all so much. I just have a hard time saying anything. Just like, imagine if you studied something and you just like built a career in something, and then all of a sudden all these fans showed up and just are like loving everything that you do for a living. It's like, wow, okay. You know, this is great. What's my real answer to your question? That's a really good one. I think people are figuring this out, but understanding power and how power works and how it flows, so that we can be really focused on how to change things. I think there was a kind of like a bit of a YouTube beef about this like a few months ago about actually get involved, actually do things. And like, I'm not going to take sides on that. I feel like it was, you know, sometimes you make a beef on purpose, even if it's a little bit over the top, just to like get some clicks, which I don't hate. But ultimately, the point is valid, and is that if we have time to do this, to like enjoy urbanism and enjoy trains and buses, we should use at least some of that time to like actively do the things that cause change, and like learn about how to do the things that cause change. So, you know, writing to city councilors and attending council meetings, totally. More and more and more people are doing that of our generation, which is super exciting. Starting nonprofits, some may say that's a good idea, but there's high barriers to doing that. I really think that we're in a moment with this like upswing of online urbanism that there are enough of us now, you know, that we can actually really swing things and change things. And that's why I am so optimistic right now. Like, I see the way that the, you know, governments are starting to change, you know, housing regulation. We haven't quite gotten there on transit, but in Canada. But it really feels like there's progress. But like, yeah, everyone learn about power. Like, for example, I think there might be an assumption that TransLink is responsible for the state of transit. And to a certain degree, like they don't evade responsibility completely, but they get money, right? Like the money that they spend comes from other sources. And so we can go directly to those sources. And they operate on city streets that they don't control. We can go to the people that control those city streets. And sometimes, you know, it's complex in that, like, you go to city council and they say one thing, they're like really supportive of transit priority, but actually sometimes it's the city officials, the leadership within the municipality, that are doing everything they can to prevent, you know, better transit. So it's context specific. It's going to be really interesting, frankly. I think if you're interested in this stuff, like, to get into it, it'll be really interesting. Oh, and to just cap that all off though, like, not to give like a real negative view of people, like, I think you all said this on the podcast previously, like, don't ascribe to malice what you can just ascribe to ignorance. Like, I don't think there are like cartoon villains that are against transit out there. But it's going to, don't act like everyone hates you and is evil. It's more just like, we really have to get on their radar and make them understand how many people care about this, and think about what they're thinking about, and really try and sometimes you have to like plow a path for them.
Yeah. And I think that's it, right? It's having educators, people who can distill down the ideas and the concepts and why we're doing it and how it can work and the benefits we can all reap from it, distilling it down and delivering it in a package that's very consumable. And I think, like, we talked about this last week when he had Yute Lee on, and about how he presents the stories that he wants to tell. He presents all the facts and tries to lay them out and lets people decide, but in a very consumable way. And I think that's really important, because when you see a lot of, especially on, okay, the online content or communication's terrible. Like, we're talking about Reddit and YouTube comments. It's a dumpster fire half of the time. Yeah, we get it. And it can bring out the worst of people. But a lot of the times you see comments and let's just say, I'm going to say repeat offenders, but let's say in the Vancouver subreddit, it's a pretty small subreddit as far as subreddits go, and I'll see the same username pop up with the same type of arguments, definitely not in favor of the things that I'm interested in. And I'm wondering if you can get through to those people by giving them the actual information. Like there was an argument about widening the Lionsgate Bridge, and I was trying to explain how that's not going to fix traffic. You can make it 20 lanes wide. It's still going to be stuck because guess what? On either side of that is the problem. Like you can't, what are you going to widen Georgia and make that like destroy half the city to make it anyway?
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know where I was going with this.
No, but I really appreciate what you're saying. Yeah. And like one of the things, the political like people that I've learned a lot from, her name is Anat Shenker Osorio. And one of the things that she always tries to remind people is that you don't need to get everyone on side. And actually, to win things, in her experience and through her research, it has actually been beneficial to get your opponents riled up. Like she says, I think like 10 or 15% of the people on the far, far opposite end of the spectrum, if they're actively opposing your thing, that helps you because that gives you a foil. Like it helps you tell a story and make it a bit more cinematic. Like, oh, this guy's, you know, angry about this and he hates you and you should support us instead. And that you only really need to get, you know, those handful of people that are don't know enough or that are in the middle and that, you know, don't preoccupy yourself with convincing everyone.
Yeah, that's a good, very good point. Yeah.
You heard it here first, folks. Don't get into Twitter arguments.
Yeah, and by the way, the video that you reference is Urban Planning YouTube has a huge problem.
Yes.
By the Nth Review. If you want to watch it, go check it out. I found it interesting. I disagreed with the facts that, you know, I think there are people know that you can make a difference. And one person we have on this podcast very regularly, Alex, is very into doing that. In fact, that's why he's not here this week, is because he's at City Council in Calgary pushing hard for RCG. So
wasn't it going to be like a 600-hour council meeting or something?
Yes.
Yeah. He's on his Unsprawling YouTube channel. They posted a few talks about it already. And yeah, definitely check that out if you're in Calgary or if you're just interested in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He is Calgary's biggest defender.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. There's people doing work, which is fantastic. All right. I want to ask about something that I'm passionate about, which is micromobility. So when it comes to micromobility and transit, the synergy is undeniable and I absolutely love it. And it's something here in Vancouver that we do pretty well, is the fact that you can take your bike on the bus or on the SkyTrain and it just extends that journey so much further. But I'm wondering what kind of things can we do with micromobility in transit to make it better?
Oh, that's a great question.
And I know there's active transport people at TransLink. I'm sorry, you're not that person, but I just wanted to ask you about it.
No, it's great. I mean, there have been some jurisdictional like issues around getting Mobi or bike share stations as close as possible to SkyTrain stations, which has been a bit of a bummer. I don't know if you've ever experienced that, Nick, on the Mobi network, where it's like, because ultimately you want that bike share station as close as possible to the platform, and then you can just whoop, right onto the train.
Yeah.
You know, and they've been doing some really exciting stuff. Like there's one card now that you can get from TransLink that allows you to use bike share, car share, and transit all with one card. It's like a pilot program.
That's great.
Yeah. It's really cool. And TransLink also has a bunch of bike parkades, which is a fun little regional term. Like a parkade is a parking garage for bikes. And you have to pay like $1 a day to a max of $8 a month to store your bike inside in a safe place. And the interesting thing about that is that it was designed for people commuting 9 to 5, and it's started getting so much, I think even busier sometimes at night, where delivery drivers who live in Surrey and Langley will leave their bikes downtown in a bike parkade overnight. Oh. And then so the bike parkades will be emptier during the day than at night.
Yeah. Interesting.
So yeah, it's just like giving all those options. Like the truth that I think we need to maybe talk more about is that bringing your vehicle, your micromobility vehicle, onto the transit vehicle, like it's a luxury that we have because we are not super transit oriented. Like in cities that are so much more transit focused, like Tokyo and London, it's not as possible. Like I think in Vancouver, it's still, you're still allowed to bring your bike onto the Canada Line 24 hours a day, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
All day long.
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's not going to last. Because, you know, as ridership grows, we just have to prioritize people over bikes. Yeah,
absolutely.
But ultimately, hopefully, like, the things that you need to get to, as we densify as a city, as we put things closer to other things, you won't need to bring your bike on the train because the thing you need will be closer to you. Like, that's part of the exciting thing about all this TOD and this density. So, yeah, I don't know if I answered the question.
No, I think so. I think, yeah, it's about having, again, it's about centralization and having those things within reach. Yeah. Obviously, the bike share is a huge part that I don't use that often, actually pretty rarely, because, yeah, again, I live close to things. I'm pretty central. Like, I live in a fantastic place where I don't need to go too far to get what I need.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a huge thing is bike share. I think that's definitely super important to extending that last mile, as we always talk about, right?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. Ethan, do you have any more questions?
Absolutely.
For Dennis?
No, none at the moment. I mean, do you have any more, Nick?
I don't think so. I got nothing on here. I wanted to talk about gas tax a little bit, but I felt like that might be too much into the weeds and how that, you know, leads to TransLink and stuff. But
yeah.
Yeah, you know, let's leave it there. This has been a fantastic conversation. So at this point, Dennis, can you give us a plug for Movement or anything else that's going on?
Sure. Well, join us. Transitmovement.ca is our website, and our handle is MovementYVR on like most social media. And join us, follow us, like us. Please volunteer if you have any like interesting skills or whatever, let us know. Cause we want to be big. We want to like have people that, you know, dance and drama people and, you know, accountants, and everyone has a role in the movement. So, thanks for you all's support and for all the support of all the people that, you know, I think we're at almost 1,000. We're getting close to 1,000 names on our list. On our way to 50,000.
Okay. Yeah. And stay tuned for that sweater. Cause you said you're going to be selling that, right?
Yeah. I've been saying that for months, and I need to actually like get off my butt and start working on that. But yeah, we'll definitely sell merch.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, wonderful. Again, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Free Urbanism. Really appreciate it. And if you want to reach us, it's at radiofreeurbanism@gmail.com, or you can just comment right on the YouTube channel and we'll definitely see it there. So yeah, that's the end of the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Y'all have a good one, folks.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. For access to early episodes, live shows, and other perks, join us on Patreon at Radio Free Urbanism.